Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
With a Jorge Martin sprint win and a Pecco Bagnaia Grand Prix win, MotoGP's 2024 season opener might look on paper like more of the same, but it also contained a thrilling glimpse of the future as Pedro Acosta made his gung-ho presence felt on the series. And maybe, just maybe, there was a little bit of evidence that Ducati won't have things all its own way this season to quite the extent we anticipated. This is the Race MotoGP podcast. I'm Matt Beer, and due to Raul Fernandez delaying the start and then Doha airport Wi-Fi not being our friend, we're actually recording this on Monday morning rather than plan A of Simon doing it from the airport fresh from rider debriefs. That does mean Simon has travelled through the night back from Qatar to Ireland before this recording. He looks fantastic on the screen. Listeners, Simon, how are you feeling?
Not fantastic. Absolutely. Like the opposite of what you've just described. That's how I feel right now. We left the circuit at 11 p.m. and at 1:15 I was in the air, having completely failed to record a podcast because last night was the first night of Ramadan and the whole of Qatar was traveling through the airport. And it was just, so I think it just, the reason the Wi-Fi didn't work is because it was overloaded.
Too much.
Everyone, plus 2,000 MotoGP paddock. Like literally you were walking through the airport and I was like, oh, there's Darren Binder. Oh, there's Jan Stigafelt. Oh, there's Luca Voskoskoro. It was like that last night at the airport, as it always is on those nights whenever everyone can actually make a flight home after a race from a flyaway. But I'm home now, so...
I'm Matt Beer. I haven't left my house. Val Hoen, she hasn't left his house as far as I know either. We both look well awake as well.
Has Val not moved house since the last podcast?
I don't remember. These past 2 weeks have been 2 years in that particular regard. So
I feel like Val's new background of near a window is one I've seen on podcasts before. Before we get into the racing, I just want to flag up something new we're doing at the race, which we're very excited about. Have you ever felt, MotoGP fan listeners, that our social media channels just have too many wheels on them? Too much of that pointy nose Formula One stuff? I can sometimes, as much as I cover both things, I can understand that. So we've launched at the Race Moto on both Twitter/X and Instagram as pure motorcycle racing social media channels. MotoGP for now, might be a few other things dropping in there over the course of the year. Simon, let's put his hand straight up.
I was arranging some interesting meetings on the bus home from the airport with our boss, Glenn Freeman, and a few others from a few other people from outside the race to potentially even lead us to something that we've never done before at the race on our new social channels. So watch this space.
That sounds very, very fun. We're going to be sharing plenty of extra insight on the social channels beyond what you get on the website, beyond what we chat about on the podcast. I don't know if giving Simon another social media avenue to make friends and enemies on is a good idea or not, but we're doing it. We've enjoyed having them this weekend. We've got a lot of big plans for them through the course of the season, as Simon's just hinted. Please do get in touch on those social media channels at The Race Moto on X and Instagram to let us know what you would like to see on there as well, because we're really keen that you help us shape what goes onto them. That is enough talk about sleep, lack of sleep, and social media. Let's get to what actually happened in Qatar. We're going to quickly give due respect to our Grand Prix winner and championship leader, Pecco Bagnaia. But sorry, Pecco, we're not going to talk about you for too long this week. But he's where we expected. And I have to say, I can sometimes be the Pecco skeptic on this podcast, but I like the style with how he took control of the race on Sunday night after a slightly iffy qualifying, slightly iffy sprint. Round the outside of nearly everyone through the first corner, then bang a move straight on Jorge Martin. Nice bit of killer instinct, Pecco. How would you sum up how he started this title defense, Val?
Yeah, it's a very, very sort of familiar story from him, and I think actually drives home something that I hadn't really thought of so much before, but that is evident. I mean, he was champion before the sprint, so he's not a sprint merchant, but it really is kind of unfair in the best way to give one of the most cerebral, maybe the most cerebral rider in the MotoGP grid, a trial race to figure things out. Because if the sprint just ran for 22 laps and that was the main race, he is not winning that. But instead, you know, he got that trial run and he knew exactly what he needed to do in the main race and he did it. He, while the other Ducatis were a bit scared by the rear chatter issues, Enea Bastianini and Jorge Martin both went a bit conservative in terms of their pace in the early going. Bagnaia basically knew I have to get to the front immediately and then I back myself to hit the same lap time for 22 laps and we're fine. 21 laps because of the Raul Fernandez thing. And that's basically exactly what happened. Brad Binder was behind him for most of the race and he described it as Bagnaia running wide maybe once and wide by like a meter wide. And that's, you know, that's typical. We've seen that a bunch of times. We'll see it a bunch more times. He is now, I don't remember the number on the all-time win list, but he's on 19 with Barry Sheen, which is quite the honor. And yeah, a lot more races on the calendar these days, but also he's fitted in all these wins since like mid-2021, right? That's insane. It's crazy. It's he really is very, very special at what he does.
So it, like in a word to describe the win, off the cuff, if I was going to describe the win, it would be textbook because it was a very textbook Pecco. I'm going to get to the front. I'm going to control this. It's going to be set at my pace. The rest of you can do whatever you want, but it's going to be set at my pace and that's going to work for me. And it did. And it was perfect. But actually, whenever you look at it a little bit more, it was more than that. It was like his performance over this race is the sort of thing that I've never seen anyone apart from people like Jorge Lorenzo, like real talent deliver. You know, whenever you look at, like, I'm just looking at his lap times here. I've had to pull them up in front of me to make this point, but he did 53.1, 53.1, 52.9, 52.8, 52.8, 52.7, 53.0. He did a 1:52.6 when he was responding to Binder in lap 9. And then he went back to 52.9, 52.9, 52.8, 53.1, 52.7, 53.0, 53.1, 53.1. It is just, you know, there's like 0.3 of a second difference for 20 laps. That is just, you know, to be able to deliver that. And I asked him about it in the press conference afterwards. And he had all the confidence in the world whenever he was like, oh, yeah, well, the bike was able to do like low 52s, but I didn't need to do low 52s. You know, it's a case of literally of winning the race at the slowest possible speed. And he set it all up in the first lap. He set it all up, you know, with those moves early on, and he knew he had to get them. He did say after the sprint race that his qualifying, that one mistake he made in, I think, the penultimate corner in qualifying is what had cost him the chance to fight for the win in the sprint race because he was too far back early on. He didn't make that mistake. And Sunday, like Val said, he learned from what he'd done wrong. He made up for it very early on. And from that point on, like there was never a point from the third corner where it looked like anyone was going to beat him.
He said he rode different to the sprint, I think more smooth. He said there was a minor setup change. So obviously, when we praise Pecco, we also have to, you know, all the praise has to go also to his crew chief, Christian Gabarini, and all the crew around him. But it's just, I think all of us shared this. I know I certainly felt that way. And this is not to say that it's bad when Pecco wins or it's not interesting or anything like that. But I think all of us, when we saw him go to the lead at turn four, will have been like, oh, this might be it. This might be game over. And he's, I think right now in MotoGP, he is the only rider who makes you feel that way when he hits to the front because he's so hard to overtake and he hits such consistent lines and consistent lap times up front.
And I'm not saying it to be facetious at this point about the difference in factory and satellite, but that being able to fix that chatter problem that everyone else has been struggling with all through testing and everything that he only really kind of discovered on in the sprint, I think, for the first time to the same severity as the other Ducatis, and he was still able to fix it in 24 hours whenever no one else could, or no one else could to that extent, is proof of how strong that team is behind him as well, and how well oiled that whole setup is.
When you talk about winning a race at the slowest possible speed in a championship like MotoGP, where you expect thrills and excitement, it feels a bit sad that someone can control a race like this. Dirty air would have played into some of how that race unfolded. At the same time, I can't help but admire someone who sets up their win at the slowest possible speed by bombing around the outside of three people at the first corner, then dive bombing your sometimes insane erstwhile title rival two corners later. The aggression was there as well before he could take control, at least.
I mean, yes, there was a little bit of an issue with aero, all the usual problems with being able to overtake and stuff, but there was never really anyone close enough to him to have that issue.
True.
You know, he maintained that 1 second gap to Binder the whole race, and that was the issue more than anything else that Binder had.
Yeah.
You know, Jorge Martin admitted afterwards that he did think about trying to close the gap a little bit to Binder and making a move in the last lap for second, but for once chose to be sensible rather than, you know, aggressive. He was close enough to be in that position. Binder wasn't. So that, you know, it was all Pecco's doing. I think it's one of those occasions where you can't really blame anything else or give anyone else credit unfairly when it was his doing. And the thing about winning at the lowest possible speed, the thing that kind of makes it okay for me is that there's 22 guys in this grid, and I think there's only one of them that's able to do that. And I think that's the reason he's double champion at the minute, because he's the only one that is able to win at the slowest possible speed. He is the only one that's able to consistently control races like this. You know, that's why I called it textbook at the opening, because it's textbook Bagnaia, but it's not textbook modern MotoGP.
It didn't feel like a pure tire management race. It didn't feel like that was the only thing dictating the results or anything like that. So, you know, it's part of the game, and that's, you know, that's how he played that part of the game, but the rest of the package was there. It's not like he just won by managing the pace. He won by doing everything, like, just strategizing the race perfectly. I'm fine with that. I think that's okay. You would like, in some circumstances, I think a full gung-ho sprint from the start to the finish, but we have sprint races for that, firstly. And, you know, some tracks, you know, use up tires less. And I think I like variety in races. I think as a race, this was basically fine. Just the quickest guy won because he hit the front right away. That happens. That's okay.
Let's move on to the opposite of the Bagnaia race approach. We've used the words aggressive and sensible in a good productive measure here. Let's talk about Pedro Acosta, who lit up the first probably two-thirds of the race by charging through the field on his MotoGP debut, then went backwards even faster, having burned up his tyres. Now, this is the reason I'm most glad we're recording in the morning, not the evening, because last night I was like, oh, the kids are going to be asleep in the room next to where I'm recording from. How am I going to be quiet enough when talking about Acosta's ride during the recording? But you could look at what happened to Acosta and go, well, that charge was false. He was burning up tyres in a way no one else was, so we can't get too excited. Or you could look at Acosta overtaking Marc Marquez in his first weekend on the MotoGP bike, charging through the field like that, and look at the spirit behind it and go, oh my, this kid is amazing. This is going to be so much fun. I'm very much in that camp. Simon, where do you see it? I think, based on our work chat during the race, you're in a similar one.
The only way that I can see that race is that Pedro Acosta decided that he was going to give us a demonstration of his talent and his lack of knowledge at the minute. That was 100% talent, and the end result was 100% lack of knowledge of managing MotoGP tires. He gave an absolutely phenomenal quote to Spanish media last night. That I'm actually, the main reason I'm glad that we didn't record the podcast until this morning is that I wouldn't have picked up on it until I saw some translations this morning. He said that his first ever MotoGP race was like losing his virginity. He went into it fantastically, thinking he was amazing, and then realized at the end he didn't know all that much. Which is just, you know, this is another part of the reason why we love the kid, because he's so articulate in the way that he's, you know, saying these things. He was completely unapologetic afterwards about having you know, but having burned up his tires. He genuinely did not care, because he knows that it's a skill he still has to learn. He knows that he's never raced a Michelin before. I think the race yesterday was probably the longest distance he's ever done on a set of Michelin tires in one go, because I don't think he did any full race simulations over testing, even though we did, you know, a few days more testing than everyone else. He knows that the next round we're going to is going to be totally different, because he doesn't know Portimao the way that he knows Qatar after 2 days of testing. And I think he wanted to have a bit of fun, make a bit of a statement and say, you know, I'm really fast, even if I'm far from the refined package right now.
The kid's playing with house money in the sense that, again, I think KTM has already seen what it needs to see in testing, but it's definitely seen what it needs to see now. He can probably have a Binder-length contract or a Marquez-length contract thrown at him already at the end of that race. And maybe that's already happened in some form. He rode basically a better version of the exact same first MotoGP race that Jorge Martin rode 3 years ago when he was making his debut in the first of the Qatar doubleheader in 2021. And he was sort of he immediately fought through like 10 positions on the opening lap and then just cooked his tires, I think. But he finished 15th, Pedro finished 9th. It looked very competitive throughout. Even once his tires went, it's not like they completely fell off a cliff. He still retained a decent finishing position. He still was basically, by every observable metric, the second best KTM rider of the four this weekend. And really not that far off of Brad Binder, who had an amazing weekend. I should have put him in the top 10 for the season.
Yes, me and Glenn,
I think that's
right.
Going to be my...
He is good, it turns out. Like you told us.
Yeah, it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt for the season. I mean, as Simon says, there will be tracks coming up with obviously less knowledge and without the preseason test. And, you know, Jorge Martin, his rookie season was really good, but it didn't always live up to that Qatar thing. But also there was the Portimao injury that conditioned so much of it. And he was still in the top 10 by the end. So increasingly, I think I've made a mess there, much like Pedro Acosta did in the final laps or whatever, losing his virginity, whatever.
I have to say, I said this to you guys last night when that quote first emerged. That's a very confident stance to take into losing your virginity. Pedro Acosta, who swaggers into that process with no self-doubt? Don't get it. Anyway, sorry, I've wrecked the podcast.
No, his confidence on... or his take on confidence. Someone asked him last night about, you know, how much pressure he's been under and et cetera, et cetera. And he just laughed and was like, I was under more pressure than most factory MotoGP riders in my second Moto3 race. And he's got a bit of a point to him. You know, there hasn't been a rider maybe since Valentino Rossi that's come up through the junior ranks with as much sort of attention focused his way. Maybe Marc Marquez, but that's it. And he's just totally accustomed to it. There are riders who turn up to media debriefs and it feels like they're there because it's a chore. And there's riders who turn up to media debriefs and it feels like they're there and they would rather be anywhere else in the world, either because it bores them or because they're quite modest and shy about it. Then there are a few riders who are like, you know, it's like watching a conductor in front of an opera. And he's one of them, you know. Rossi does it. Cal Crutchlow was really good at it, where it feels like they are controlling everything. They are the one, you know, making the jokes and setting the narrative and getting people to laugh. And he's just, yeah, watching him work media, it comes so naturally to him that I genuinely believe him when I say that none of this pressures him. He's just, you know, he's just super chill with it. And the other thing is that, you know, we haven't really talked about this at all. I don't think anyone's really talked about this post-race, but thinking about those long contracts and what the future holds now, because we're going to have that conversation really, really soon, especially if Jack Miller keeps falling off trying to keep up with Acosta. You know, this race also proved to Acosta that the KTM is a bike that he should be on.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
He went there with a one-year deal with the option, we're all pretty sure, of looking elsewhere for next year if the Austrian bike wasn't quite up to speed. But I think that's buried that conversation too. Like, he's going to be a KTM rider for a while, and he's going to be KTM's first world champion in MotoGP, 100%.
I mean, that's bold, but I see no reason to disagree. And, you know, I was having to like remind myself that we've seen quite a few impressive MotoGP debuts. I'm thinking like back to James Toseland qualifying on the front row in what was really a bit of a different era. Now Johann Zarco leading those laps on his debut, but then the proper comparison is someone like Marquez getting the podium on his debut, and that was in a different era as well, on a more competitive bike than Acosta had.
Yeah,
for this weekend. It's a rookie season. There's going to be ups and downs. I'm sure he'll be falling off a few times, and Qatar will occasionally look like a a positive blip, and he does have to sort the tire management thing out. But you made that Jorge Martin comparison from his debut, and of course that was post-COVID year. We had back-to-back Qatar races, but what did he do next time? Stuck it on pole, finished on the podium. So, and that's Jorge Martin, who is not someone we think of as a man with great capacity for learning and using.
Wow, that's harsh. Well, for learning, for race-based longevity, I would disagree very much on the learning thing, considering that, I mean, he's won like 15 sprints in a row now. Clearly, he's learned something.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, that was harsh.
If we were racing at Qatar again next weekend, I'd be putting money on Acosta for a sprint podium.
Yeah,
I agree.
No, if we were back-to-back, easy.
And like you say, with the Jack Miller point, it's sad to say it already, but there was a moment in the TV direction where there was a kind of in-screen, small screen replay of Miller crashing just as Acosta was pulling off when he was overtaking moves on someone in the top six or seven. And it was like, this is a very obvious comparison to make, but you can't fault them for doing it. It makes it a really tough start to a crucial season for Miller.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie? Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
So if Pedro Acosta is a new Marc Marquez, we should talk about the original Marc Marquez as well and how we judge his first race on the Ducati, which ended with fourth place in the Grand Prix. Tricky one, in a way. I mean, if you were in the camp that expected him to dominate as soon as he got on that bike, no podiums at the weekend, that looks underwhelming. Equally, first race in a new bike after so long with a different one, still question marks over his long-term fitness, and Qatar not historically a brilliant track for him. Val, was this underwhelming or ominous for everyone else in your eyes?
It's fantastic. I think he did an amazing job. I think it's a great result, and I am considerably more confident about the idea of Marc Marquez pushing for the title this season than I had been coming into the weekend. I mean, he said his usual thing of how, you know, Pecco Bagnaia and Jorge Martin are still riding the bike better than him. He's still not alluding to the actual bike difference at all. He's just saying it's all about the experience and the knowledge and the, you know, the attunedness that Bagnaia and Martin have with the bike. But from where I'm sitting, I'm seeing a guy who finished 3.4 seconds off the win at a track he flat out does not like. I thought it was really good. I thought there was genuinely no particular complaints to be made given what we saw in the preseason. Okay, if the preseason was a bit stronger than this, then yeah, maybe you would have expected him to, on the podium, in one of the two races, but we know he doesn't like Qatar. We know that the adaptation process is still going on. His pace held up very nicely through the race until the final couple laps. He just gave up and decided to finish the race, which I think in his Honda times, he would have chucked it down the road trying to catch Martin, I think almost inevitably. But here, the fact that he's settling for the points almost to me suggests that there's something in the championship to play for. The only really, for me, lingering question mark, not in terms of how the performance will compare to Bagnaia, because there will be swings and roundabouts with that, with Martin, with Bastianini, with the other GB23s, like, okay. But the big question mark for me is how much of this was the knowledge of the test and how much there will be track-specific learning to be done at places like Portimao. But he does not like Qatar. And he was, you know, he was a front runner all weekend. No question about it. And it also doesn't count, but he was also, what, the quickest in the wet session? Of course he was. He's still the same guy. He'll be fine. This will be a good season. I'm bullish. I am coming out of this weekend bullish.
Yeah, I'm still not 100% sure about the title, because Prime Marc Marquez at Qatar was a podium finisher, even if it isn't his best circuit and not somewhere he loves. So let's say I'm back in the podium before we start making title assertions. But, I mean, put all of your life savings on him winning at the Circuit of the Americas or the Saxon Ring. He is going to win races this year. I was pretty sure of that before this. I am now absolutely certain of it. But there's so much potential left for them to unplug from this bike. And this, you know, that's the whole combination. I think he's been very quiet on his own sort of aspirations and everything. But I think he left very happy. He left Qatar with what he'd wanted to do. He didn't set the world on fire, but nonetheless, really strong results. There, thereabouts. The best possible building block, really. Because I think the other thing is, you know, if he'd went out and win both races here, then the pressure would really be piling on, and we'd be having really different conversations going forward, and it would look terrible whenever he goes to Portimao and wasn't in those same positions, which I don't think he will be, because it's going to be, Portimao is going to be a much tougher circuit to make this bike very quickly work around.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think for his own expectations, for the expectations of the people watching at home, for balance and everything, I think this was the weekend that he needed this to be. No better, no worse. And it's only going to get better from here, really. It's just where it kind of settles into a you know, rhythm every weekend of where that best is.
Yeah, it was very close. The margins separating him from victory and pole were small, much smaller than the results throughout the weekend suggest.
Yeah.
It just felt to me so much like so many of the starts of his title campaigns. You know, okay, he had a few second places to Andrea Dovizioso in some of their title battles in Qatar. There were Qatar races where he wasn't on the podium, and he still went on to, well, in 2015 that didn't become a title, but 2017 it did. You know, this is not a place where he normally takes control, apart from that one-off 2014 when he won absolutely everything that season almost. So it felt like the start of a Marquez title he'd always used to, in terms of results, if perhaps not in terms of how he's carrying himself, given how cagey he's still being about his own situation.
He was 1,700ths off pole without a toe.
Yeah.
I think at Qatar, that's really good. I think that's really, really good. So again, Portimao, I have my reservations about, and he probably isn't too happy about, you know, Termas dropping off. But I think we're going to see something really interesting come, not just Kota, because Kota everybody expects, but come like the usual traditional European track leg. That's usually, that would be where he just did the damage and made the title race look like not a thing anymore. And well, I don't think it'll be that this season, but I think we'll see something very interesting, and I think in a positive sense from Marquez.
One thing that kind of contradicts everything I have just said about not being sure yet, when we throw it out anyway, is a stat that Spanish journalist friend Swinsky worked out post-race, in that Mark has finished in the top four at Liseo. This was his ninth time in the top four across three classes. and every previous time he's went on to win the championship.
Yeah.
So, you know.
The thing is, it had that vibe in terms of his results. The different part of it wasn't that it was people like a Dovizioso finishing ahead or someone who you thought might struggle at a different track or might be a one-off flurry. It was Bagnaia sticking the big points, and it was Martin doing likewise. That's the only difference for me this season. It might be that we're about to find out that Marquez is still as good as he always was, but he's up against a set of packages that are a lot better than his old opposition used to be, or at least sort of latter half of the 2010s when Yamaha was having its problems. Lorenzo was finding his way on Ducati. Rossi was fading. You know, I certainly wouldn't question the quality of opposition at the very top end that Marquez had in his first few seasons. But yeah, he was able to win titles on a not good Honda, partly through his own genius, partly because everyone else was all over the place for a little while then. Let's talk about the teams that made Ducati's life a bit harder. Something we mentioned in the intro at the start of the episode. You know, we've been predicting an absolute Ducati whitewash of this season, and I think that's still going to be the case. But until the Grand Prix start, at least, Aprilia looked very, very interesting, and Brad Binder and KTM come away from that with a pair of podiums and right in the thick of things in the championship. Let's do KTM first, because they actually made it stick across the weekend. We always talk about how hard KTM is to judge after testing, because testing for KTM is just like, whoa, and then the result could be something completely different. Is this genuine KTM on Ducati pace going into the season, though, Simon? He's shaking his head straight away.
Nah, it's KTM at a circuit where their bike has been pretty good and coming off the back of a load of testing. We know that if there's one thing that the KTM loves, it's data. When you look at you know, their performances at the circuits that they used to test at over the years. You know, Danny Pedrosa, podium contention at Misano straight after testing at Misano. Yeah. That bike likes data. It likes numbers. It likes experience. And I think that's partly what we're seeing this week. I don't think it's entirely what we're seeing. Don't get me wrong. They obviously have made the bike better. And I think they've made it closer to the Ducati. They've certainly made it a hell of a lot closer to the 2023 Ducatis, which, you know, it wasn't close to the 23 Ducati 3 months ago. So they've made improvements there. Obviously, the 24 bike is looking better. But I think considering Ducati had issues to iron out this week, and just, you know, considering the amount of time we've had on track at LaSalle and the fact that we lost a little bit of track time, which also helps balance out things for the other manufacturers generally. All in all, they will deliver better results this year. Brad Binder will win races this year, but I don't see them being in a position to put together a full title challenge, especially while, to be completely frank, he's getting very little support from the other bikes.
I think, you know, what we spoke about in the top 10 episode, like this makes my wins point again. Brad Binder couldn't have really done more this weekend in terms of a win shot, right? I don't think so. And if this was a different weekend or a different... There have been MotoGP race-winning weekends much worse than what Brad Binder managed this weekend.
Yes.
Because Ducati was 1, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, I think. And Brad Binder was the 2.
Yeah.
So it's the exact thing that we were talking about in the podcast. In that podcast, I think I the same things that give Simon pause give me pause. I still remember the 22 opener where after a so-so preseason, they rocked up to Qatar and he was second to Enea Bastianini. And the season from there on was fine, but it wasn't anything too special. He dragged himself to sixth in the Riders' Championship, but I think we all felt that flattered the bike a little bit. The bike is more competitive now, obviously, but Ducati competitive across the range of tracks? Yeah, I really, really struggle to believe it. But he is doing his part. And I think that's important. And again, I really resent the idea of being like a Binder fan or whatever. I don't want to be a fan of anybody. That's not what I'm here for. But it's just super impressive. We would rightly lose our minds over a rider in those circumstances, you know, being the only non-Ducati rider in the top 7 and being in second place just behind the winner, we think that's mega. And okay, Pedro Costa's going to get much closer this season. It is going to be uncomfortable. very soon. But I would not write Binder off as a potential first world champion for KTM just yet. Not because, I mean, I do think Acosta's ceiling is probably higher, but I don't think Binder has done anything wrong in these last 3 years to suggest that he can't be. It's like, again, I've said the, you know, my line is that if he started seasons on a Ducati, there's a good chance he'd just be the preseason title favorite or at least joint favorite. I still believe that. I think this weekend showed that again. I think he was super impressive. And he can qualify it okay now. And obviously the KTM off the line continues to be just amazing. And it's free real estate on the grid every single time. And this is going to be a slight tangent, so I apologize because already Simon wants to say something, and instead I've gone on one of my stupid rants. But we were being asked, well, I started tallying qualifying scores for the season between teammates because I want to see who wins the inter-team qualifying battles. And there's a message on social media that, like, it doesn't really matter in MotoGP so much. And that's not true. It does. It massively matters. Grid position is hugely important in modern MotoGP. But KTM is the manufacturer that's hacking it. It's not the best qualifying bike, but it is cheating the system in this regard because its grid position is automatically inflated by a row basically every single time. Aprilia is reverse hacking it, but we'll get to them. We'll get to them shortly.
Aprilia starts. The reason for me that I see Acosta as KTM's sort of champion elect at this point is that the timeline. Brad Binder will be 29 at the end of this season. I think that their best opportunity...
Geriatric.
Their best opportunity to win a title will probably come under the new regulations, because I think it's going to take the regulation change to upset the Ducati dominance. I think we're going to see Ducati dominance in 25 and 26 as well with the timeline that this bike's on. So you're looking then at you know, a guy who's in his sort of nearly mid-30s. As a first time champion, I can't see it. That for me is the sole thing at this point that's working against him.
Well, I can see that. I can see him doing it if the bike is good enough. What I find harder is the thought that he could do it ahead of someone in their early 20s at that point who we think has a higher talent ceiling. And I think, in absolute fairness to Brad Binder, I think the Brad Binder non-wins thing is rubbish as well, Val. I don't think you should criticize someone for being second, not first, when really they should be sixth or seventh. Given the bike they're on, in a lot of those second places, he is outperforming that bike a lot of the time. But go on, Simon.
We need to see a bit of time this season, I think, to see if that is actually the case anymore, though.
Yeah, that's true.
Because
that's true.
Whenever a rookie is suddenly running in fifth place, maybe the bike's not as bad as we thought it was at all. It's just that Jack Miller is quite disappointing on it.
Well, it's not even that it's bad. It's just it's not Ducati good. That's the issue for me. It's like it's not a sixth. If there's two Ducatis, the KTM's not a sixth place bike. There's a million Ducatis, and that's why getting the KTM on the podium so much impresses me so much from Binder.
But I see what Simon means, and yeah, Miller's again. I think I'm more positive on Miller than anybody else on this panel. This really was a really bad weekend, and he knows it, and he'll know it right away. Like basically, none of the sessions went right, apart from was it qualifying, kind of. But yeah, both races.
Yeah.
I mean, even once he remounted after the crash, he admitted that the bike didn't feel damaged, but the pace just wasn't there. And the thing is, the pace is kind of already there for Acosta. So how do you stem that particular tide? How do you arrest that momentum? I don't know. It's a tough predicament to be in, certainly.
I know we've been talking about this in the work chat a little bit this weekend, and it's something to pick up at a later date. But I don't see Jack Miller finishing the season on the factory bike. I see Pedro Acosta taking his place before this year is out.
And just to get into that a little bit now, because I think it is worthwhile, the obvious response to that is, what would the need be? But I think I do see where you're coming from, in that if KTM feels Acosta is going to be ready for a title shot and its bike is going to be ready for a title shot as early as 2025, there could be a logic to getting him familiar with the big team sooner. You know, just make... Yeah, it's very Red Bull F1 logic rather than the logic we've seen from any MotoGP team so far, really. We've seen people walk out of teams mid-season in the Vinales case, but a mid-season demotion would be new territory. But Red Bull, as a KTM partner, does have form in that regard, and Acosta looks like the best hope of a Red Bull MotoGP team winning a title at the moment.
And they now have title sponsorship over both satellite and factory team, which is just something to bear in mind.
Let's head into everybody's favorite part of the MotoGP podcast, which is called Formula One Corner, in which I think we will... there is just one, I think, distinction that is so important that for me makes it a non-starter mid-season for now. I mean, let's see what happens, but for now. I think when you shift somebody from Toro Rosso to Red Bull, or whatever that team is called now, it's different cars. So you get used to specifically the idiosyncrasies. All right. Yeah, idiosyncrasies of that particular car. You get to learn to drive the family of that particular car. Whereas here it's the same bike. It's the KTM RC16. It might have some slightly different parts for the works team, but again, they can make that happen for Tech 3 whenever they want to. And I know the crew argument, but equally I think it's such a rocking of the cart that you would only do if you wanted him to learn specifically new machinery for me. And he doesn't need to because the bike's the same.
See, I think for me, it's learning how to operate within a factory environment, because as much as they're a satellite back team, they're not a factory, or a factory back team, they're not a factory team. It's having 40 people listening to your feedback instead of 4 after every session, and then helping them manage how you're doing things with electronic strategy. And at the minute, I'd imagine an awful lot of what he's doing in terms of testing and development and fine-tuning the bike is hand-me-down stuff, in that he's getting parts that the factory boys have already signed off on. They're using modified versions of electronic strategies that's working for Brad Binder. It's getting him into an environment where he can do all that himself. It wouldn't be something that I'd ever consider would be worthwhile doing if you were looking for, if you were looking to train up a number two for Brad Binder. But I think that they see Acosta, they should be seeing Acosta as a potential team leader in the very near future. And that for me is what kind of tips the balance into, there's a motivation for doing it.
Well, talking about KTM's electric starts a minute ago, you mentioned Aprilia being the opposite of that. I thought we might be talking about Aprilia quite a lot in this podcast. Instead, it's going to be a little bit brief. A lot of people's favourite for the race win on pure long run pace going into Sunday, and Aleix Espargaró qualified second, finished third in the sprint, did make a bad start in the Grand Prix, but it wasn't just a bad start, was it? This became miserable for him.
It was awful. It was a complete disaster. I mean, the start was a kind of typical Aprilia bad start, where he just engaged reverse gear and was down, down a row of the grid by the time we got to turn one, and then it got worse.
Yeah, exactly.
But he ruled out, actually, to be fair to Aleix, he's not someone that normally reverts to blaming tires. It's not really something that he ever uses as an excuse, to the extent that he told me earlier in the weekend that that it had happened to him like once or twice in the last few years, full stop, and he didn't really understand why everyone else complained about it so much. And then kind of jokingly put the blame for his poor race on me for asking the question and jinxing him after he got a bad tire, he claims, on Sunday. Obviously something wasn't right. There was something not right. That was not the performance we expected from him. It wasn't the performance that the vast majority of his rivals that we spoke to expected from him either. Marc Marquez was completely, completely certain that Aleix was the guy to win the race after the sprint race. So something went wrong, but I think it's one of these things where maybe Aleix's own words will haunt him a little bit, in that he made a very good argument earlier in the weekend when I did ask him about it, about how he doesn't really think that there's such a thing as bad tires. It's that the tires are super sensitive. And I think maybe what we saw was that bad start combined with having to go too hard early on in the race to try and make up some of that, burning things up a little bit quickly. And it just got all out of hand, and it ended up with a disaster. Complete unmitigated disaster. And yet, in saying that, he had a complete unmitigated disaster and was still by far the best Aprilia, because everyone else had an even worse day.
Yeah. I also want to preface everything I say by saying that he's had a great weekend and was head and shoulders the best Aprilia. even while, you know, accounting for the other issues like, you know, Miguel Oliveira's long lap that I completely forgot about until like 30 minutes before the start of the race. And I wouldn't be surprised if he was in the same boat there. Or Raul Fernandez's bike showing up with an error code and then him having a dispute on the grid over whether he can actually take the start or not. Or just Maverick Vinales losing his way and then, I guess, finding it, but not really, but maybe, but not really again.
No comment.
Story of his life.
Yeah, poor fella. But the thing with Aleix is, you know, he was genuinely super fast and super, super impressive. And clearly that new seat unit on the Aprilia that both Vinales and Oliveira aren't using yet, they can't really wrap their heads around it too well. But Aleix has immediately taken on board, and is clearly it's giving him something extra for his, you know, for his riding style and for his dimensions. It's giving him what he described as Formula One like corner speed, which, you know, fair enough. I think the rivals are seeing that too. But I think tire or no tire, clearly something was off there. But I think his race was done in terms of the victory hopes by like turn five or turn four. I think what happened in the sprint wasn't really going to happen in the race. And, you know, as good as his late race pace was promised to be, I think there just wasn't that drop off on Sunday that Saturday promised. There wasn't Jorge Martin out front, tentative and feeling rear vibrations and not confident. There was Pecco Bagnaia just hitting the same lap time over and over and over again in complete control. The problem for Aleix right now, and it will be a problem basically all season, I suspect, is however good his late race pace is, he can never rely in modern MotoGP on that race pace, ensuring that he can overtake the three or four positions he loses off the start. You can't make sure of that. Even if you're quicker, you cannot guarantee it. And this was the one big thing that gave me pause after Saturday is, you know, whatever bad tire, if he's fifth again out of turn one, I can't be sure that he can definitely reclaim those positions. And we didn't get to see it play out like we would have, but I think still Bagnaia wins it from there. That's my suspicion. But of course, it still would have been nice to at least see Aleix mix it there or thereabouts, because his weekend deserved it. I think it was awesome. I think he's having an awesome start to the season.
Yeah, I agree completely. A good weekend for him. If everything had gone well for him, would have been podium battle. He would have been in there with Binder and Martin, and most likely would have got the better of one of them and ended up second or third. But those first three corners by Bagnaia, I don't see anyone could have stopped that.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Don't just ride the index, seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
On to 2023 title contender corner next, and very differing fortunes for the two guys who made Bagnaia's life hardest last year. Jorge Martin won the sprint despite a few problems with his bike and was then third in the main race, very amusingly saying that he held back from having a go at Binge on the last lap, which made us all look at the gap at that point and going, what kind of go were you intending to have there exactly? But yeah, bless him for thinking of it. But he's coming away at least right in the thick of it in the Riders' Championship again, and fairly similar to where he was last year. Weirdly, I don't feel there's actually much to say about Jorge Martin after this weekend. Anyone disagree?
Well, I mean, I feel like your comment earlier about him not learning stuff was is mitigated somewhat by the fact that he didn't make a move on Binder, even though he was like three quarters of a second behind him, and it would have been the most ambitious lunge we've seen in a long time.
I'm used to being the Jorge Martin defender around here, where you two accuse him of arrogance for making ludicrous tire choices and that, and falling off when leading and that sort of thing. And now I'm copying flak for being harsh on him. But anyway,
he did jinx himself completely on Saturday afternoon by saying that he didn't want to become the second person in history to lead the MotoGP World Championship for only 24 hours, like he did after Mandalika, where he won the sprint race, went into the title lead, and then lost it again 24 hours when he fell off in the main race. He remains the only person ever to have done it, and now he's done it twice. The sprint race was by far his best performance of the weekend, because the bike was having issues and he was able to control the race and still, you know, manage the pace at the front and be the guy that won, the guy that came out on top of it. The Sunday race was, I think, joking aside, actually a good example of him being quite canny and quite, you know, quite willing to settle for a good podium to start a season. He specifically referenced last year's start to the season, where him and Miguel Oliveira got wiped out in the first race at Portimao by Marc Marquez, and how much better things were this year than last year. So I think maybe the lessons of losing the title has sunk in a little bit. Maybe this is a bit of a new leaf, a new calmer, more prepared to settle when he needs to, Jorge Martin.
I think there's a sustainable path to the championship here. He's just 3 points off Bagnaia coming out of the weekend. That's nothing. That's literally nothing. They might as well be level on points. They might as well have gone 1-1 on this one.
Yeah.
So
no, I agree. I think logically it's better. He's not 28 points behind like he was at this point last year. But it just the reason I said I don't think as much to say is because it just feels like last year has continued. For those two, you couldn't split them, even though they're very different approaches, you couldn't split them at the end of last season, and they've started this season in exactly the same way. Bagnaia a little bit more aggressive than we saw at times at the end of last season. Martin a little bit more canny than we saw at times at the end of last season. But bodes pretty well for a year-long replay of 2023 with added Marquez in the background, which will do nicely. But the person who was missing from that narrative, who was so much part of it this time, well, not this time last year, but very early last year, Marco Bezzecchi. We knew he was struggling a bit in testing, but wow, what a absolutely terrible in every way weekend for him. Just was not at any stage remotely quick. What is going on with Bez right now?
Strong contender for, I think, the worst weekend of his MotoGP career, aside from like the ones where he got hurt, but maybe also including the ones that he got hurt, because at least when you get hurt, you can point to the fact of being hurt as the reason for what's happening. Bezzecchi did feel like he made some progress in the Sunday morning warm-up. I struggled to put too much stock into that generally because it's a daytime session in Qatar. So it is kind of different to everything else going on in the weekend. But he felt there was some step forward in terms of his understanding of this 2023 Ducati that's giving him a headache. And then just in the race, he felt like he had a lot of front locking and couldn't run any reasonably competitive pace. But generally there's something not right, and I think the Qatar weekend showed that, and testing had shown that, but there were glimpses or suggestions that maybe he's on the right path. And the problem is, well, problem number one is Fabio Di Giovannantonio was in space on Saturday, like, you know, absolutely in space and dodging oncoming bikes, and he had unmistakably the better weekend by a huge margin. And he was flying. He hit his foot on the ground. He again had to dodge oncoming bikes, which, side note, I hate that. Like, it feels like every weekend we have to go, oh, he was lucky to avoid oncoming bikes there. I hate it so much. I hate it. We talked about this before, but I hate it. Fabio Giannantonio had the better weekend, looks by far the stronger VR46 Ducati rider right now. It's concerning for Bezzecchi, because it also, like, the things he say, and he admitted it himself, are sounding like the exact same things that Enea Bastianini was talking about when it comes to his fit with the 2023 Ducati last year. So now Bezzecchi has the same Speca bike, and he's likewise having corner entry problems and, you know, not being able to just keep the line and get into the corner like he wants to. So it's probably won't be as bad as other tracks, I imagine, but it is exactly the start of the season that he did not need or did not think about possible. It calls into question his decision to pick the 2023 bike and VR46 over the 2024 bike and Pramac. For as much as we understand the logic behind that decision, there is now, you know, logic aside, there is now a case to be made that he made a mistake, he rolled the dice and he was wrong. And I fear that that is going to become the consensus over the next few rounds. But, you know, let's see. It's just Qatar. There's time.
Putting Bezzecchi's weekend into context, though, he finished behind a Yamaha and two Hondas. And as much as you could look at a few parts of the weekend, there were some moments in qualifying where I thought Johann Zarco looked really promising. There were moments in the race when Quartararo moved forward, particularly Mir made a little bit of progress. This is overall, this is still more evidence of how far Honda and Yamaha have got to go. And Fabio Quartararo is saying after the race that in terms of like relative competitiveness, this is the Yamaha's worst position. That's really sobering stuff. And I'm going to ban us now from going to Quartararo 2025 rider market talk, but it's in the background. He's in this season where Yamaha's trying to win him over for the long term again, and he's starting it saying, we've never been further from the pace. That's bad. And it's new problems too, isn't it? That's the other thing. Yamaha encountered things this weekend that were problems with what used to be its strengths.
Yeah. It was awful. It was awful. Remember on the one of the test podcasts, I went into how Yamaha felt like my big disappointment despite the general vibe of optimism coming out of the camp. And I felt at that moment that was a really good chance for me to have egg on my face come the Qatar opener, to just, you know, feel stupid about what I said. And instead, I should have been much harsher. This is bad. This is bad. The bike is no bueno. I keep saying that when Yamaha comes up. I don't know why. I don't know why that's my go-to phrase. It almost doesn't matter that the race pace wasn't good. And I guess in the main race, it fixed a bit. In the sprint, the tire performance fell away. So in the race, they ran a more conservative engine mapping and it seemed okay. But does it, like, who cares? I mean, people care. It's people's job to care. But you're not fighting for anything because you can't qualify, because you can't get into Q2. Whatever, season's over. Goodbye. That's where I'm at with Yamaha right now. Two very good riders. One of them still coming off a very, very nasty injury last season, obviously. And there is nothing for them to work on. One of the things Fabio said in his typical Fabio self, because again, he does not mince his words when he does debriefs and sometimes says things that are probably even harsher than he intends them to be. One of the things he says was that not only is there a chasm to the European manufacturers, but also we're even worse than Honda. Which, by the way, that's Honda catching a big stray from Fabio. But I understand what he means and I see it. I get it. I think he is probably a stronger rider than the Honda camp right now. And he barely beat them. It's very difficult. And it's Qatar. I will remind you that Yamaha is the MotoGP's winningest manufacturer in Qatar. It has 10 Grand Prix wins. Fabio is responsible for one of those in the Martin podium race that came up earlier in this episode. Just terrible. It's, I don't know, it has top speed now, but it's still just, it doesn't have anything else, I guess. I don't know what to say. I don't know where they go from here. They'll need to fix things. They'll need to use their concessions to maximum of their ability. And it's taking all of my willpower right now not to go into 2025. So I will just cut myself off here.
And the problem that they've got is that, you know, it's going to get worse because, you know, he said, we've got a disadvantage to Honda right now. Well, Juan Mir said the same thing. Mir was like we're quite upbeat post-race. I think the only reason he really finished behind Quartararo was because he got a bit carried away towards the end and burned out his tires the two laps to go and admitted that he'd been a bit dumb and had made a bit of a bad mistake. But he was, you know, he was super positive in his debrief last night. The contrast was stark. He was smiling. He was joking. He was sounded like someone that thinks they've made a bit of progress. And we know that there was a test last week in Jerez where Cal Crutchlow was there for Yamaha and Stefan Bradl was there for Honda. The parts that Crutchlow tested and liked, the factory Yamaha team had this weekend, the parts that Brattle tested and liked aren't coming for Honda until Portimao. So this is already an upgraded Yamaha from the last time they were here versus a Honda that's waiting on upgrades that they think are positive, and they couldn't really keep up with them because Mir had an advantage. This is good. I didn't think this season would be this dark for them. I expected them to make a bit of very slow, very steady progress, but I kind of thought that they'd always be ahead of Honda as they did so. And I'm not so sure they will anymore, which is, yeah, that's terrifying especially if you're Quartararo.
So listeners, that is what struck us in the opening round of the 2024 season and our opinions on it. Next week, we're keen to hear what you want to know about the 2024 season, and maybe you can take us to task with some of those opinions if you disagree with them as well. We're going to do a listeners' questions episode in the gap between Qatar and Portimao. So whatever you want to ask us about the season so far and the prospects for the rest of it, email podcast@the-race.com. Send us a voice note, send us an email, whatever you prefer. And Simon, Val, and I'll be back here next week putting our brains to what you've asked us. Thank you for your company today, and we'll be back in your ears very soon.
The Athletic.